Hi, I'm Christopher Ross, BSc, the Director of Photography for CATS, and you're listening to the Go Creative Show.
Hey everyone, my name is Ben Consoli. I am a director and owner of BC Media Productions. This is the Go Creative Show, the show dedicated to creative professionals and filmmakers. Today we talk about the brand new film adaptation of CATS, with Director of Photography, Christopher Ross. The Go Creative Show is supported by Hedge, Shutterstock, Rule Boston Camera, and Premium Beat. Well, I want to start today's show with a giant thank you to all of you supportive Go Creative Show listeners. We're in our 200th episode. This is our 200th episode. I'm absolutely blown away. This is a milestone for us, you know? We've been doing this show for nearly 7 years now. We might even be into our seventh year. It's insane. We've reached number one on iTunes multiple times, nearly 2 million downloads. Got an opportunity to talk with, A-list directors of photography and production designers. And I mean, it's just been such a wild ride, and I'm so appreciative of all the support out there. So thank you guys. Now, we wanted to do something kind of different for our 200th episode, but it didn't really work out because we got an opportunity to talk to Christopher Ross, the director of photography for CATS, and that's who we're talking to today. And I certainly do not want to move that interview just because of the number of the episode. No. So what we're going to do instead is early in January, we're going to have an episode with a panel of filmmaking experts. Now, we've done this before in the past, I think about 2 or 3 years ago. And we're going to do it again. We've got my director of photography, Chris Loughran, who works on all the BC Media Productions jobs. We're going to talk to colorist Rob Bissette. And we're going to bring Matt Russell back on the show to talk about audio. And it's going to be kind of a roundup of what we saw in 2019 and what we are expecting in 2020 in film and video production. So it's going to be an awesome conversation. We did that a couple of years ago. It was a huge success, and we are doing it again, and that's going to act as our 200 episode celebration. So that's going to be a fun one. So look forward to that in early January. But now it's all about CATS. We've got Christopher Ross, the director of photography for the film, coming on in just a couple of minutes, and we've got tons to talk about, including how he was filming on these gigantic, oversized, large-scale sets, and some tips for filming choreography. We haven't talked about that that much on Go Creative Show, so there's a lot to learn there. You guys are going to like it. Now, do you know what the hot color trends in video production will be in 2020? Well, you could know. You could know. All you have to do is visit the blog at Shutterstock. Yes, Shutterstock. You know, we talk about Shutterstock every week, obviously. They've got millions of images, millions of video clips. We have those fantastic Shutterstock select clips that I've been talking about. But I want to bring your attention to their blog. Their blog is excellent. They've got a million different stories there, and they are so dedicated to educating us creatives in the film and production community. Their blog is broken up into categories: editors, designers, business, video production, of course. And they just have these really interesting stories like this Color Trends 2020, where they talk about what is to come. They give you the hex code. They give you some clips that are in that color range. Color is so important in videography and filmmaking that, you know, sometimes when you're looking for that stock clip, you want to have something that fits your color palette. Shutterstock is paying attention to those things, and they're making sure that they are giving us all information about how to incorporate color into your productions. I mean, this is just one of a million great stories on the blog. What I love about it is it shows their dedication to educating us. That is super important. So you go to the blog. It's free. Learn. Just check it out for yourself. Get inspired. That's what Shutterstock is all about. Check them out at shutterstock.com. All right. We've got so much to get into with Christopher Ross, the director of photography for CATS. So I'm here with Christopher Ross, the director of photography for CATS, and a whole bunch of other films that we're going to be talking about too. Christopher, thank you so much for being on.
Thank you so much for the invitation. It's a pleasure to come and talk about cinematography.
I can't wait to hear about it because Cats is very unique for a bunch of reasons. The large-scale sets, the cinematography, lighting, it's such a fantastical adventure that there's going to be a lot to talk about. So I'm looking forward to that. But I kind of want to start with just setting the scene here. You just came back from a screening of this in New York, and you have had no sleep at all. So it's we're really catching you in the thick of this, aren't we?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, as Tom said at the premiere, the premiere was Monday night, and as Tom said at the premiere, we literally finished the film at 8 a.m. Sunday morning with just enough time to strike the DCP between 8 a.m. and 21 hours later when it needed to get on a plane and get to New York for the Monday night. So it's been a race to get the film finished and a race to do the best job we could, kind of thing.
Wow. So they were really, what work was still being done, you know, less than a day before the release?
There was work going on continuously with VFX. So I'm obviously party to the very final moment of bedding all of the material together in the grade with our amazing colorist, Adam Glassman. And so we had, you know, about 4 weeks ago, we had a version of every shot in the film. And then Tom every day would go into VFX reviews and make notes to make things better. And the VFX team carried on going. And over those 4 weeks, there were vast improvements to the work, or improvements that we felt were worthy of finding their way into the film. And that led all the way up until that Sunday morning when we were dropping shots in the middle of the night, Saturday night into Sunday morning, to then finesse in the grade and get ready. So yeah, it's been a race to get this to the finishing post.
The Tom we're talking about, by the way, is Tom Hooper, the film's director. Now, the trailer for this came out a long time ago, like months ago. And Do you ever kind of get nervous when trailers come out that early? Because people are so judgmental about trailers that it can work as a positive or a negative when you put a trailer out there and sort of set the scene for people's expectations. I mean, how do you feel about that?
Yeah, well, I guess because I'm a DP rather than a director or a producer, I tend to think more empirically about the work, which is, you know, the work that we do is based on script and, you know, thousands of creative conversations, and that culminates in the creation of a huge sort of collaborative experience that goes to the cinema, and the trailers are, I guess, an indicator of that ultimate creative intent, and they're viewed by audiences. And the audiences form opinions of which the filmmakers have no control.
Yeah.
And so the one thing that was apparent when the trailer came out was that there was a huge reception to that trailer. You know, I think in the first 4 weeks of the trailer being out, it was seen by 120 million people, or downloaded and viewed by 120 million people. So Universal and Working Title were very happy with the audience feedback kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then because they were relatively preliminary visual effects shots that were in that trailer, I think there were 96 shots in that first trailer. Tom, director, used it as a guide to refine the work going forwards. Hmm. So, but it was a great response.
Yeah, I think you're seeing that more and more too. Like, I think that Sonic the Hedgehog movie put a trailer out. People they hated the look of Sonic. And I think the whole, everything kind of stopped and they just completely restructured the look of Sonic.
Yeah.
People are really, I mean, studios, I think, are really responding to or reacting to the response of the trailers that go out. It's kind of interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what I found interesting about the first conversations that we had about Cats when I joined the team was that you know what you usually get, what animators in visual effects houses are usually doing is anthropomorphizing inanimate objects. So they're more used to taking a toy like a cowboy and turning him into Woody, or a spork and turning it into Sporky. What they're less used to doing is animalizing human beings.
Yeah.
And taking what is essentially human and blending it with something that is idiosyncratically animal. And I found that really, really interesting because what Tom wanted to do was he wanted to move away from the original, you know, stage show concept of these floppy tails that follow actors around and static ears and bring their characters to the fore with the use of tails and ear animation. And that I think is one of the things that was moved forward quite away from the first trailer.
Was that a hard sell for people?
No, I don't think so. The concept of the film, the concept of these characters is really, really out there. And I think what we're asking audiences to do is to buy into this villainization of the performers. Mm. And they're not cats, because they can't be cats, because cats walk on four legs and don't sing. A two-hour version of real cats attempting to do this is a film that I definitely never want to see. but the felinized ballet dancers and the felinized vocalists that we have amongst our cast are definitely, you know, entirely captivating. And I think audiences will respond.
Let's talk about the set design, which is, you know, in the trailers, it certainly looks very real, but I thought to myself, it's gotta be, for the most part, CG. It has to be. But the more I'm learning about this film and, you know, now seeing more trailers and seeing more behind the scenes, these are real sets, large, gigantic scale sets. I absolutely love this move to a more practical type of cinematography. What are your thoughts?
So the production designer is this amazing designer called Eve Stewart, and she'd worked with Tom on his previous three films. She's truly astonishing, and it was conversations between Tom and Eve that led to the scaling of the world. So the scale, so it's hard to scale a cat and a human because cats walk on four legs and humans on two. But if you stand a cat on its hind legs and equate that with an averagely sized human standing, you know, on his two legs, then the scale that you get is 2.5 times. And so that was the scale applied to all of the sets. So our bedroom, as an example, the bedroom of Mungo Jerry's set, which was one of the first that we photographed, was 38 feet deep by 30 feet wide. Wow. As a single room, and the soundstage was 29 feet high, which wasn't high enough for the actual ceiling. So the ceiling and the top sort of 3 feet of the room are CG as a set extension. The door to the bedroom is 24 feet high. and 9 inches deep instead of the three inches deep of a regular hardwood door of that era. So we had this. So that was, for example, one of our spaces that was built. We also built Jenny Anydot's kitchen to the same sort of a scale. The street where Grisabella sings Memory, the Rum Tum Tugger sings his song, and Bustopher Jones. All of those songs are sung in a scaled up replica of a street in Soho called Great Windmill Street, and it was built on a soundstage on L Stage in Leavesden, which is 440 feet long,
wow,
by 110 feet wide.
What's the height on that?
And that it's still 29 feet high.
Oh, okay.
So basically all the street was built to the top of the first floor,
yeah,
the top of the ground floor. And so everything above that is a set extension. So from a design and lighting perspective, we knew that there was above the Windmill Theatre, there was a big awning, and we wanted a certain colour of light to be emanated by the awning of the theatre, and the Rising Sun pub, as an example, has a large neon sign above the door, and then there's a theatre at one end which has an illuminated sign. And so I placed fixtures into the rigging that would reflect off of the surface of the cobbles and the paving slabs to mimic the lights that would be drawn in our set extensions.
Mm.
Basically,
yeah. Talk to me about some of the challenges of filming at a scale like that. Like, what sort of accommodations do you need to make in your cinematography to account for the scale?
It's pretty complicated.
Yeah. I would imagine things like camera moves would be difficult. I mean, the perspectives are all strange.
Yeah, absolutely. So the one thing that you need to look at a sort of three sides of things. One is the how do you deal with the mind's perception of depth. So how do we make sure that the cats look small against this big backdrop, but also how do we make sure that the backdrop doesn't look big but the cats look small?
Yeah,
is one side of things. The other side of things,
well, before you even go to the next thing, how do you do that?
If you use a very wide angle lens, that what tends to happen with the image, so the wider you go, the center of frame tends to remain distortion free, but the edges of the lens tend to have an amplified magnification, and therefore they distort perspective.
Yeah.
And therefore, as a viewer looking at that image, you know that you are being manipulated. But the irony with the scenario is when you build a very, very big set, you need to use very wide lenses in order to see off the top of the set. You know, if you want to stand on a soundstage and see the height of a door that's 24 feet high, you need to use a wide angle lens to see that height. So you're immediately caught in a catch 22. And that was one of the reasons, one of the things that led us to using the Alexa 65 and the Prime DNA lenses, was that when you shoot like a angle of view on an Alexa 65, so as an example, you can shoot on an Alexa 65 on a 28mm, which is approximately equivalent to a standard Alexa on a 14mm.
Mm.
And the 14mm on a standard Alexa exhibits problematic linear distortion problems, basically. Mm. Whereas the 28mm on the Alexa 65 feels more like a 50 mil on the regular Alexa because it lacks this linear distortion. So
similar to the way that, like, I'm sure a lot of people in our audience may have like a 35 millimeter crop camera and a full frame camera, and the lenses look drastically different on either of them. Yeah,
exactly. And like, you know, if any of the audience members have ever mixed, you know, shooting, you know, 35 millimeter street photography with maybe a Mamiya 6.7 or a Mamiya 7 rangefinder, and you notice that the 40 millimeter on the Mamiya rangefinder has a much more relaxed wide angle view, and that's because the lenses that are doing the work are having to do less work over the same pieces of glass in order to get the same angle of view because your target size is much bigger. Mm. And so that was one of the reasons for going with the Alexa 65, basically, as well as the fact that it's very simply put the best, you know, most beautiful digital camera, you know, in the world right now. Yeah. It's sort of unsurpassable in its image quality.
Let's take a quick moment and talk about Hedge. Hedge is a backup software for filmmakers. Now, it allows you to import multiple sources and send it to multiple destinations at the same time, so it's perfect for creating multiple backups on set. You can get the Hedge Connect app for your phone and get a notification when the transfer is done. It's a free app, and they are constantly updating Hedge to make sure that you have the latest and greatest in backup software. Now, I use Hedge on sets like this. You know, I get the camera cards from my camera operators. I get cards from my audio techs, behind the scenes photographers. I throw them all into Hedge, and then I set my destinations as two separate hard drives so I can have a double backup. Press transfer, and I just let it go. That's it. It is simple. And that's exactly what you want. You want it to be simple. You want it to be fast. You know, before I was using Hedge, I was just dragging files all over the Finder. And I hated that. You know, you're never 100% sure that your media is being backed up correctly. You certainly don't have the type of tools that allow you to have these multiple backups and all of that. You're certainly not going to get a notification from your Finder when something's done. No, Hedge is the professional way to manage your media and to back up your media. And the media is the most important thing at the end of the shoot day, so treat it the right way. Now, you go to hedge.video/gocreativeshow. You get 20% off the full license. And there's also a whole bunch of other license options there too. But I strongly urge you to check this software out. They are always updating it so you have the latest and greatest. These guys are obsessed with making the best backup software possible and so much more. It's all there at hedge.video/gocreativeshow. What focal lengths were you working in?
So we had a full range of the Prime DNAs. So the widest lens is a 12 mil, ranging 12, 18, 21, 28, and then all the way up to the 200 millimeter.
Sure.
But we tended to sit between the 28 and the 55.
Did you have to do anything to the lenses to eliminate any distortion in the lens? Or, I mean, I'm sure you could do it in post too, but did you do anything to the lenses?
No. I tested a lot of the I get basically the medium format style of lens, the Prime DNAs, the Signatures, Takinas, Takina Vistas, the Sigmas, and the Prime DNAs were the best, had the best contrast for us to use, basically. Mm. And provided that we stayed upwards of the 21 millimeter, didn't really show. So the 21 millimeter was a signature prime, but upwards of the 21 millimeter didn't really show any linear distortion problems. And then there are a couple of shots in the Rum Tum Tugger and a couple of crane shots where we needed to get very, very wide, but with very limited limited camera height capability because you know, what we wanted to do is we wanted to do in our street the equivalent of a crane shot in a regular street. But we were limited to the top of the ground floor. So you couldn't really do a crane shot like you would normally do in a street. So there were a couple of shots that we did that were on the 12 millimeter to fake that we were even higher.
Hmm. So you must have, you probably had to move really fast too to adjust for that scale. Like the crane shot.
Yeah, yeah.
What were you just like, you were just tilting down more drastically or did you just.
Yeah, to swing the crane, to make the crane shot feel relevant to the environment,
yeah.
You have to move the crane significantly faster. So any shot that was purely architectural and that wasn't specifically about a dance, you know, an element of a dance, a graphical shape of a dance, a piece of character emotion or whatever. When it was here are the cats in this space, those crane shots were achieved at 2.5 times the crane speed, basically, to make it feel like you were in a real human scale environment.
How did you address close-ups, or not even close-ups, but when or even medium shots? Like, are you worried at all about the close-ups and the medium shots losing that scale because of just the nature of how tight the shot is and because the sets are so big, you don't really get to see much of them?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. So when I first met Tom, I brought a sort of a presentation to him that was that analyzed what Piccadilly Circus and Trafalgar Square looked like in the 1930s, what sort of light illumination was around, what color gas light really is, bits about scaling. So I brought lots of examples from Toy Story about how you deal with scale.
Yeah.
And one of the main ways you deal with scale is that you don't do close-ups. So if you watch any one of the Toy Stories, you very rarely, other than in the most emotional moments, have a close-up of Woody or a close-up of Buzz. They're always, they're always cowboy thighs and up on the toys, and that's one of the things that helps keep the scale, is that you're always seeing a bigger world in relation to a smaller toy. We don't have that luxury. We have characters that are singing lead vocal for 4.5 minutes. And so the way that we worked around that was to try to retain as many depth cues as possible. So I used a lot of smoke in the backgrounds to give a sense of diminishing perspective in even the smaller sets, to try to make the smaller sets feel significantly deeper. And we tended to use much wider lenses. So so most of the close-ups in the film are on a 35 millimeter or a 45 millimeter. And so the 45 is really the for me was like the hero lens of the set, whereby you get this beautiful soft roundness to the close-ups, like a real three-dimensionality to the focus fall off and the way the lens renders a face, but you also get to see a huge amount of set. So it was about trying to keep as much set in as possible at the same time, and also to keep things in frame that give you a guide in the real world as to how big the cats are. So you'll often see them next to an oversized chair, or next to an oversized bin, or next to a curb, or next to a milk bottle. The idea being that these everyday items act as a scaling guide, as a depth cue to how big our world is, basically. So we kind of sit in this hybrid world where it's absolutely impossible in every shot to keep the sense of scale. But what we need to be able to do is every three shots to have a reminder so that you feel intimately involved with the vocalist or intimately involved in the dance routine, and then you're reminded of the scale, just so that it becomes a thing that you keep in the back of your mind. But also, we have to realize that what we're trying to do is also a deeply emotional connection with our cast members and with our characters. And so you can't be too draconian about about the way that you deal with scale and the way that you deal with the oversizedness of things. And you have to let a little bit of chaos and a little bit of fun come into things, because that's where the emotion comes. And if you're not connected to the characters because you're trying to keep a handle on how big things are, then you've pushed things too far the other way.
Mm. Now, with all the visual effects, I'm assuming these actors are wearing like motion capture suits for the fur to attach onto later. Did you have to make any, did you have to make any decisions by way of camera or lens or even format that you're shooting in order to account for that?
Yeah, well, so the dancers were basically wearing like an all-in-one leotard with fluorescent tracking markers on certain parts of their body. Some of the dancers were wearing a certain type of suit called an XN suit for positional data capture underneath this Lycra suit. I guess the most significant thing that I did that I got involved in with the VFX and costume department was to twin the color of the costumes to the color of the cats were going to end up. So that what I didn't want to do is I didn't want to go for a very soft, sort of generic top light as can happen in VFX heavy films. Mm. I wanted there to be a real character to the light. I wanted there to be hard light. I wanted there to be deep shadows. I wanted there to be high contrast at times. I wanted the world to feel as real as possible. So there are, so as an example, the bedroom has a light that comes into the room through the crack of the door as if it's from the hallway light. And also it comes through the main part of the door and creates an area of light and shadow as if it's a bare bulb in the hallway type thing. Mm-hmm. And that, by using that technique, when you look at the room without the cats in a wide frame, it feels exactly like a real space. So for me, it was all about making the spaces look real in the widest imagery, and then to manipulate the close-ups in a way that were characterful for the characters, basically. And so one of the things that I was very wary of was the VFX team wanted all the cats to be in, varying degrees of blue and green screen suits. And from a lighting perspective, they're a bit of a nightmare. It's a complete nightmare because they bounce green light everywhere. And yeah, it's a sort of a disaster. So what I wanted to do is when two cats were nuzzling each other and one of the cats was white and one of the cats was brown, that the white cat had brown light bounced into her eyes and the brown cat had white light bounced into her eyes, and that we could use that light in its original color in the final piece.
You achieved that by just altering the wardrobe to
altering the wardrobe to the exact color of the cat. I mean, that's not, you know, it's not a thing that happens all the time, but it definitely was a thing that stopped us from having this sort of proliferation of green and blue light around the sets that we lit hard.
Yeah, I can imagine, especially with like tons of dancers standing near each other. I mean, the bounce would have been terrible.
Yeah, absolutely. And so we wanted, and there's, you know, in the big theater set, there's a very big, a very large, hard moonlight source. It's not particularly hard in the end because the moon is, I scaled the lighting, by 2.5 times as well. So that we could get the equivalent shadow hardness, basically. Yeah. But so the front face, say you would use an 18K that has a front face of about 3 feet for your moonlight. If you were going to use one of those lights, I would build a rig that was 2.5 times that. So we'd have a circle of light that was, you know, 9 feet across, 9 feet in diameter, in order to produce a column of light for our moonlight, so that it felt when you were using coherent light that the coherent light was coming from a source that was human sized rather than cat sized.
God, it sounds so mathematical. Like, it sounds like a science project, this whole thing, having to worry about all the scaling and this. Oh my God, there's so much more that's going into it than I think anybody watching is going to realize.
Yeah, but I think that's a good thing. I think,
of course,
I think, if you can watch the film and it looks effortless, then
done your job. Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
One of our, Facebook, friends here, Diego Fabricio, Diaz Palomo asks, how were you involved in the production design for the whole movie? Sounds like you were involved in at least wardrobe, but anything else? I know Eve Stewart, your production designer, we talked about earlier in the show. Talk about the involvement you had in pre-production and production design.
Well, so Eve and Tom have made, this is their fourth film together. And they have an incredibly close collaboration. And I worked with Eve on a different project about 3 years ago. And at that point, they were gearing up to make Cats sometime in the near future, and she had already put together a whole heap of, you know, amazing concept art for Tom to pitch to the studio and to bounce around conversations. And so they've pretty much been working on the project for about 4 years. Wow. I think by the time that I showed up, and by the time that I'd showed up, Eve had already begun work on constructing the sets. You know, the construction of the L stage street set took about 18 weeks from start to finish. Mm. And I came on board with about 12 weeks of pre-production to go. My involvement really with the production design was working with Eve and her team to coordinate where the practical lighting, where that would go, how I could utilize practical lighting to motivate other light sources, and conversely, by utilizing my light sources, motivate where a practical could go. So the idea was that we knew that we had at least three more stories of Soho above our level on the street and in all the different environments. And so we wanted it to feel like this neon lit neon lit collision of color.
It's an extraordinarily colorful film. I mean, that's for sure.
The thing that I wanted to try to do is, so if you actually analyze a street, streets that a small scale are really quite boring, because at human level, the amount of light that there is in a sort of a standard night exterior set covers, if you expand the distance, covers a huge zone. So one street light, actually, when you multiply the light from that one street light, can cover half of our soundstage. And I felt that would be long term would prove fairly tedious, that these cats would never be able to move from one light source to another light source. Like, you know, so what makes a night exterior walk and talk scene dramatic is this evolution of light. As someone walks down the street, the street light falls off and it becomes, you know, a street light goes from a front light to a side light to a back light, and then the next street light takes over. So you get this, you know, in just 30 feet of a character walking, you get storytelling simply by the light modeling around someone's face.
Yeah. That and makes sense.
So for me, it was like, how do I do that at this bigger scale? So the way that I worked it was that I said, right, so the windmill has a color associated with it, and the milk bar has a color associated with it, and the outside of Jenny Enidot's house has a color associated with it, and the Egyptian has a color associated with it. And so as characters move around this street, they evolve from one space to another space. Mm. And so hopefully you feel, as you're watching the film, that there's a new evolution of story as they move around the space. And the same goes for the theater. So about 40% of the film exists in the Egyptian theater set. And it starts with the Jellicle Ball and then moves on to Gus the theater cat. Then it moves on to Skimbleshanks the railway cat. Then it moves on to Mr. Mistopheles, and then finally Memory, and then the Journey to the Heaviside Layer. So you have all of these musical numbers that are existing within the same space. And so by using characters to control their environment, I modified the coloration and the lighting style for each of the routines, basically. I forgot McCavity. McCavity is also in the same space. And so as each character takes over the environment, the environment modifies to resemble their story. So McCavity is a big show-stopping number. She's like a cabaret act. And so when Taylor comes down on her moon, there's moving lights and a real kind of Chicago style, cabaret style light show that transforms the space for Taylor's routine. Whereas Gus the theater cat is speaking about, you know, the death of traditional sort of vaudevillian theater, and so he's lit just by the footlights of the theater, and the rest of the theater is plunged into darkness. So it was about how do we modify this space to make it emotionally cohesive with the characters, but also to in such a huge scale render some form of visual storytelling and evolution of movement kind of thing.
You are listening to the PremiumBeat.com Song of the Week. This one is called Beacon in Deep Space by Viami Metto. Premium Beat, of course, is where to go for all of your royalty-free music and sound effects. Over at premiumbeat.com, you get access to a collection of thousands of royalty-free tracks for as low as $49 each. $49! You don't just get the individual track, no. Most of the songs have stems and cutdowns and loop sets. Really, what you're getting is amazing quality music that fits your project perfectly and all the pieces to customize it. It really is amazing what they give you for $50. It's crazy. So check out this song, Beacon in the Deep Space. And also check out some other tracks too. I know you're going to find something that you love. I do all the time, all the time. PremiumBeat.com. Oh, we have so much more to talk about with Christopher Ross, but just want to take a quick break and talk about Rule Boston Camera. Rule is the place to go to purchase and rent all of your production equipment. You know why? Because all the big, huge Hollywood films that come through Boston, they use Rule. Of course they do. Because Rule is the best. It's the biggest. It's the best. And they've got a gigantic world-class inventory of everything that you could possibly need. Cameras, audio, lighting, grip gear, communications, they have it all. They've been in business for nearly 40 years, so you can imagine what they have in there. But the most important thing is their customer service, because production is mission critical. You know, you're renting because you don't own the equipment, and if you don't own the equipment, you may not know it as well as you would like to. And Rule makes sure that you understand this equipment before you take it out. You're going to get expert advice and counsel in pre-production, technical guidance when you take the equipment out for your shoot, and they're committed to support you while you're on location. So we're talking about peace of mind, and that's why I continue to go to Rule all the time. I'm there pretty much weekly. I guess that's a good sign. It means we're busy. I love that. Rule.com, R-U-L-E.com. Check it out for yourself and experience the Rule way. I had read that in preparation for shooting this, you gave yourself a history lesson in film musicals, starting at 42nd Street, going all the way to La La Land. What did you learn from that experience watching, you know, film musicals?
Yeah, I watched a lot of film musicals. I put together like a 45-minute edit of great musical, like iconic musical moments that I shared with Tom. Which were, yeah, ranging from 42nd Street, Singing in the Rain, American in Paris, you know, Cabaret. And so one of the things that you find is very, very common is the use of a proscenium layering and geometry. So right from so Broadway Melody.
Filming as if it were a stage.
Yeah, absolutely. So you've got, so you go, okay, right, center frame is our dancer. Left and right of frame are our backing dancers. It's a thing that is used to exemplify stage, you know, being on stage, basically. Yeah. The replication of the stage experience. So that's one thing. Then another thing is that the use of the wide frame. So, you know, like Fred Astaire famously had his when I'm dancing, you have to see my full body. Clause in his contract.
Yeah, you got to see the feet.
You got to see the feet, exactly. So that was another thing. And if you look at, you know, you can look at Broadway Melody of 1936. You can look at West Side Story. You can look at La La Land. You can look at, you know, videos from This Is America or Lemonade. And it's the same. You know, you find yourself in the same scenario. But one thing that we wanted to do was to play with this idea of the proscenium, and so we wanted to have the proscenium capability, or at least the layering. So not necessarily the proscenium capability, but the layering and the geometry of the dance to be in multiple axes. So it wasn't just front on where you saw a geometric version of the dance. So you could shoot one moment front on, one moment, that same moment in profile, and that same moment at 45 degrees, and you would have the same sort of layering. That was like one thing that we came to learn from the history of musicals.
Yeah.
The other thing that you learn is the use of spotlight and the use of hard light to show the graphic form of a body in the middle of a dance, and you use soft light to show the beauty of the lead vocalist.
Yeah,
pretty standard stuff.
Now, did you, with these lessons, you know, you're armed with these lessons, you're armed with that education. Did you seek to, you know, replicate some of these things in cats, or were you trying to break the mold a little bit?
A bit of both, basically. So there are times. So the McCavity, as an example, is a cabaret number, and so there are many times where we create a proscenium arch for Taylor to control the floor with, basically, in different places.
Yeah.
And then in counter to that, the Jellicle Ball is a kind of mesmerizing dance extravaganza where all 52 of our dancers become possessed by the moonlight and go off on a fantastical adventure.
Yeah, yeah.
Incredibly emotional experience. And for that, we were using an almost constantly moving camera. There's a couple of sort of graphical frames whereby cats sort of address the moon, and then we start to move alongside the cats and around the cats. So there was a lot of sort of circular Steadicam shots and interior spiraling Steadicam maneuvers, and crane top shots, that kind of a thing.
Now, I mean, most people aren't or may not in their career get the opportunity to shoot these large scale, big choreographed scenes. So I'd love to know from your experience, what are some things that people don't necessarily know about shooting that? Like, what surprised you about how you have to address your coverage and your camera movements for large choreographed scenes?
Yeah. Well, so, I mean, the lessons that you learn are, you know, often there's only one sweet spot for the choreography.
Mm.
And no matter how hard you try, they're, you know, 6 inches to the left or 6 inches to the right, and you're stacking dancers up. When you have that many dancers, and you've spiked all of the dancers on the soundstage floor, any error in a camera position or any error from one of the dancers can render the whole thing not useless, but can show
it ruins the shape of the shot.
Ruin the shape, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So the dance, you know, it's so that's the for me that was the most difficult partnership is the song and the dance.
Is there something fun about that, or was it frustrating being limited to only certain angles?
No, there's a lot of fun. There's a lot of fun with that. I find it fun. I find the conundrum fun. It's like, okay, so this is our hero perspective. Where else is there? So what you'd find is if that one camera drifted a foot to the left or the right, then that frame was ruined. But what you could do is you could move, you know, 45 degrees around and be on a different lens, and the positions that would be ruinous would be out of frame. And so it was about how do you, we shot with three cameras the whole time. So it was how do we find another sweet spot? Where is there a shot? So if this is the shot that shows the spectacle of the dance, now where is the shot that shows the emotion of the dance or the acrobatic of the dance? Mm. You know, that shows the sinewy strain on the dancer's muscles, that kind of thing. So it was about how do we partner those up, kind of thing.
Were you involved at all in any of the choreography rehearsals, or did you get a chance to perhaps maybe even modify some stuff the way that you may have done in with a wardrobe?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, so Andy Blankenbuehler, the our choreographer, amazing choreographer who took care of Hamilton and won a Tony for his hard work.
Yeah, yeah.
He had about 10 weeks of rehearsals with the cast and the main chorus dancers, and He started the rehearsals in the schedule order that we were due to shoot them in the film. And so every day that they would be rehearsing, so they'd get in at 6 in the morning. Frankie would do an hour of ballet rehearsals with the rest of the ballet dancers. And then they'd stretch for an hour. Then they'd start main rehearsals at 8 a.m. with everybody else. And they basically put a shape to each of the numbers. And then Tom would generally be around for about half of that session in the morning. I would come along at the end of that session, and Andy would run like the 30 seconds or the minutes worth of rehearsal that they'd been working on that morning.
Yeah.
And I'd photograph it. I'd dance around with the, you know, we'd do two or three takes of it. I'd dance around with my iPhone and shoot some frames, sometimes in the mix of it with Frankie, sometimes on the outside of the main ring to get a view of it. And then the same would happen in the afternoon, and at sort of 6 o'clock, as we were finishing off, I'd shoot another set of rehearsals, and all of that material would go back to our sort of rehearsal log. Tom would rewatch it all, and then the next time we were rehearsing that number, we'd address any of the notes, basically. So yeah, it was, and then in the workshop, in the dance workshop, the production design team built replicas of all of the sets drawn out on the floor in tape, so that the dancers knew where the walls were going to be, where the bins were going to be, where the curbs were going to be, so that Andy could choreograph the dancers exactly in tune with our real spaces. And then we'd then do, once the sets were constructed and once the choreography was settled, Andy would then go and do even more rehearsals on the physical sound stages to get the dancers used to the oversized scale. You know, like things like, so our cobblestones were, you know, whereas a cobblestone would normally, you know, have a, you know, a third of an inch sort of lip to the edge of the cobblestone, our cobblestones had an inch lip, so you could easily twist an ankle or whatever. And our curbs, instead of being 6 inches high, were 17 inches high. And so if you were doing a dance routine that revolved jumping up and down the curbs or jumping in and out of the milk flow or any of that stuff, actually, you know, you're jumping 5 feet in the air, 6 feet in the air. So we used lots and lots of wire rigs that you would never think that you would need to use, but a lot of our cast were doing tumbles from 14 feet in the air down onto the ground and then into all fours and scampering away.
Wow.
You know, in a cat technique. So from both my perspective and from the performance perspective, you know, I hope we try to make it look as effortless as possible. But actually, when you see what the dancers are physically doing, it's absolutely extreme. And the sort of things that we're doing are absolutely extreme.
We've got a question here on Instagram from SatKSax19. Wants to know, why could Cats not be shot like The Adventures of Tintin, putting CG people in CG environments? And I don't want to put more words in your mouth, but it seems like, well, I guess it could have been. It's just you guys chose not to.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's sort of a question more for Tom, director, than for myself, but I know the answer. Really, it comes down to a philosophical choice. So if you use motion capture and you record a human's performance in a motion capture space, what you're really doing is capturing their facial features and an approximation of their body movements. And then you're really placing their facial features on an animated object. Whereas what Tom wanted to do was to take the absolute precise movement of the finest dancers in the world and to retain that fine retain that fine movement and that fine detail in their muscle structure and their sense of tone and poise and grace, and to have the animators only dealing with applying fur to those fine details. And so that you don't have an animator, so you don't have a cat that can dance in a way that no human can.
Yeah.
You have a cat that dances like the greatest human dancer can dance.
And again, I mean, this is an adaptation of a play where people are playing cats. So it's like it wouldn't have made sense to have the whole thing virtual. I mean, it's not what this is. And I think it would be a detriment to the movie, and I think it would pull people out of the story to do that. So I'm glad you didn't.
I think so. Yeah. I mean, I think that was Tom's entire modus operandi, really, which was everything about our environments should be real, everything about the dance should be real, and everything about the physical performance should be retained. And the absolute minimum of the performer is removed in the quest for villainification. And so, you know, the images of Jennifer when she's singing Memory are as untouched as humanly possible, to allow every movement of her cheeks, every movement of her lips, every crease of an eye to come through in the performance. And the same goes for Frankie when she's dancing, same goes for Robbie when he's dancing. It was all about how do we get to a place where you have these incredible feline characters that have as much human in them as physically possible.
In our last couple minutes, I just want to talk about your involvement or lack of involvement in post-production. Talk to me about that.
So I finished on the film at the end of principal photography in March, and went on to shoot another film. And I've really been back with the film since the middle of September. So my involvement in post-production has been mostly feeding back from a grading scenario into what the visual effects work has been, what the visual effects work has been doing. Mm. But Tom has been very, 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 very kind to the original photography and has used the original photography as the blueprint for everything that is done in the virtual world. So only the lights that are illuminating our physical sets are the lights that are illuminating our cats. And so if there's a light that was illuminating the cats on a soundstage in February, then there's a light that directly replaces that light in a virtual environment to light the fur. Yeah, basically.
That's so cool. So everything again, we're seeing is what was everything we're seeing in the film is what was intended by you from a lighting perspective. I love that.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I mean, even to a point where I've said to Tom, you know, wouldn't it be great if we didn't do that? wouldn't it be great if we maybe, wrapped the light around it a little bit more, or, you know, whatever. And he's like, no, that's filmmaking. That's what we did on the day. It's all about, you know, the lightning in the bottle, really, for Tom. So that's what we did on the day. That's the performance that was captured. That's the choice that Melanie, the editor, has made to include this moment because it has this poignancy. Let's not mess with that. Let's work our way to augment that into our scenario, getting fur onto the performers, but let's not mess with the emotional content of the material by modifying anything. So it's always been about going back to going back to what we did on the shoot day, and I think if Tom could do anything again, the thing that he's spoken about, you know, wishing he did more of, was building more sets. You know, he would have loved to have built Piccadilly Circus, but it was just too vast a prospect for us. So that's Piccadilly Circus really is the only 360-degree blue screen, green screen environment in the whole film. But I lit the environment as if there were 360 degrees of you know, neon lights and flashing advertising and all that sort of stuff.
You can't do it all, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. You can't.
And I'm sure a large portion of that budget was given to that gigantic star-studded cast. Wow. I mean,
I guess so. I mean, it was a very, very ambitious project. I mean, it remains a very, very ambitious project. And building at that scale, I know, was incredibly expensive from a production design perspective. Lighting to that scale was, just in the one street environment that we had, there were 4,800 channels of dimming in the one street.
In
the 440 feet, controlling practicals, controlling lights that were reflecting. Lights that were key lights, controlling the milk bar and its crazy zany, you know, light show that it has during Rum Tum Tugger. With two Grand MA desks controlled by the desk ops, Lawrence and Simon, and under the watchful eye of my wonderful gaffer, Mark Clayton. It was a huge, huge undertaking, and I hope people respond to its ambition.
Well, they certainly will. The film is absolutely amazing. It is so fun to watch. It must have been so fun to be part of. I'm just so thankful that it had gotten made. Like, when you hear about the fact that they're bringing Cats to the big screen, you're sort of like, really? and then the more you hear about it, then you start seeing the trailer, you start seeing the behind the scenes, you're like, this is going to be a smash. So you've got a hit on your hands, and well deserving of it.
Fantastic. Thank you very much, Ben.
Christopher Ross, BSC.com. You can find him on his website and on Instagram. I don't know how to pronounce this. E-D-J-I Bevel?
Edgy Bevel.
Edgy Bevel.
It's a name that I was given by a director, a friend of mine, Mark Evans, many years ago, when he felt that Christopher Ross was too ordinary a name for a cinematographer, and I needed something more dark, interesting, and Eastern European sounding, and so he referred to me as Edgy Bevel, and I like it, so it's stuck as my Instagram tag.
There you go, Edgy Bevel on Instagram. We'll put a link to all his stuff in the show notes. We didn't even get a chance to talk about Yesterday, one of the best films of this year, I think, this summer, the Beatles film. I mean, my God, there's just so much to talk about, and no more time, so we're going to have you back to discuss.
No worries. I'd love to come back. Yeah, I had a lot of fun with Danny Boyle on that project. So yeah, there's lots to talk about there too.
Well, there you go. Something to look forward to in 2020. We'll have you back to talk about your new film, and we got to talk about Yesterday too. So that'll come up in an episode to come. But thank you so much, Christopher, for being on the Go Creative Show.
No worries. Thank you very much for the invite. It's been a total pleasure.
I want to thank Christopher Ross for coming on Go Creative Show to talk about his new film, Cats. I'm really psyched for this one. It looks so good. I love movie musicals anyway, but I just love the realism that they're trying to portray in this film. It's really awesome. And it was cool just hearing how he, you know, filmed these things. What he has to think about when he's shooting this stuff. For the scale and for it all. It was a really fun conversation. I hope you guys loved it. Please let us know what you think on our social media. Follow us at Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. Let us know what you think of the show, guest suggestions, and also check us out regularly, because we always let you know when we have upcoming guests and give you an opportunity to have your question heard on the show. I also want to thank our producer, Connor Crosby. You can find him at ignitionvisuals.com. Sound.com, and Matt Russell, who mixes and masters and makes the show sound so good. You can find him at GainStructure.com. GainStructure.com. Of course, it all begins with a visit at GoCreativeShow.com for all things Go Creative Show. 200 episodes, people, and we have you to thank. So thank you guys so much for being there, listening to the show. We are continuing on, certainly. Let's hear it for 200 more. I love the sound of that. Of course, I want to thank our sponsors, Rule Boston Camera, Shutterstock, Hedge, and Premium Beat. I want to thank you guys, too, because without you, we wouldn't have made it this far. So please support those that support us, and we are going to keep going on to our next 200 episodes, right? Talk to you guys next week. Bye-bye.